Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Angus Table today. This morning we're at Ingen in Queensland with a couple of very passionate Angus breeders, Jeremy and Julie Shaw from J.S. Grazen. So we're actually at their kitchen table this morning, so we call it the Angus Table. Thanks for being on the Angus Table, Jeremy and Julie.
That's good to have you.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us.
We had a Queensland Angus event at Emerald, ahead of the Agro Bull Sale a couple of years ago, and Jeremy and Julie were very kind to come along, and they did the breakfast talk and gave some really good information. We thought it was such a good story that we'd then like to share it with the whole Angus community across Australia. So, Jeremy, this is your family place.
Yeah.
We're sitting here. Do you want to tell us a bit about, how did you arrive here today? What's the family background and what do you farm here?
It's pretty broad, I guess. My father grew up in the area, grew up in Ingen actually, and his grandfather and uncle were on the place next door, Kevington, and he worked there till he got married, I guess, and his grandfather gave him 1280, which we measure things in 1280 acres because of the soldier settlers blocks out here. And he sort of pieced a lot together. He would have had 18 or 20,000 acres that he just kept buying over the years since when they were married, and was lucky enough to put it all together close and next door to each other, I guess. And then he got me into a block, Mount Hutton, which is only one place away. When I left, well, I was 19, I think, at the time. And then we bought and sold a few places around, from Condamine to Ben Lomond and Nundle, but we've based ourselves here, or in Troom, actually. We have a block at Troom. So, but yeah, we've always come back to this, to the home place. So I guess it's 24,000 acres here now, 24,000 or 5,000 acres. And we think it's all right anyway.
Good on you. 640 acres is a square mile, I think, and that was off in the soldier settlement blocks,
yep.
I think, weren't they?
Yeah, the poor buggers, they would have come home from the war, and like there would have been a lot of timber and prickly pear and that in them days, so a lot of them would have starved, I reckon. Yeah, anyway, but that's how a lot of the blocks are 640 or 1280 around here, like the block, actual blocks.
And how many inches of rainfall do you get here, Jeremy, on average here?
About 24, and that's... Yeah, it's more a summer dominant, I'd say, rainfall. You can be pretty light on until the end of the year, and it'll make a year look all right rainfall-wise. But, yeah, we'd a hard here. You're looking outside now. Grass has still got colour in it in July, which is very rare, you know. But, I'd say we'd a hard enough here, and it's a more spring-summer sort of rainfall.
And what sort of grasses, for those that are listening, do you get up in this part of the world?
Buffalo grass is probably the one that we rely on the most. I guess it's not an easy area to get legumes and things into your pastures, but, yeah, a fair few native pastures as well, what would you say, Jeremy?
Bluegrass and speargrass and stuff like that. We've got a big range of soil types, I guess you'd say. We go from Brigalow soil to Bora sand, really.
Okay.
It's, rocky box country. Yeah, we've got a bit of everything. And, buffalo. We have been getting a fair bit of creeping bluegrass, which has really got going over the last... probably 5 years. We planned it probably 10 years ago, but it's really, we've had a few back-to-back good seasons, which has really got it going. And, we're always looking for that silver bullet, I guess, or the you know, a pasture that'll compete with a buffalo and is like a legume or a more improved sort of one. Yeah. I mean,
but saying that, your buffalo is a good species out there, isn't it? On you, and is that right on the sandy country? It works quite well.
It works well. We'd be buggered without it, I guess. It's the buffalo belt, I guess they call it. But yeah, it frosts obviously in the winter, and you've got to sort of supplement the protein through winter, but responds really well in that lighter country. Like the lighter country will jump away with the shower of rain and come spring, and the heavier stuff will hold on for a long, you know, once you get a bit of rain, that it'll hold on for long. Yeah.
Now you're about an hour north of Roma, so if you look at an Australian map, you're about an hour out of Roma, roughly speaking. You're inside the tick line, so you don't have any issues with ticks. Do you have any buffalo fly pressure or anything like that here?
Yeah, that tends to, over summer, it's definitely an issue, and it's getting probably a harder one to manage, but it'll sometimes, when would you say it varies a little year to year when they come in and...
With your northern winds they'll come with the wind basically from the north, we find anyway, and we'll know if they're in the valley, Arcadia Valley or north of India, and well, we've got a week or fortnight or a few weeks until they get here, you know, and yeah, that it's just something you've got to deal with. Like, everyone's got their problems.
Yep. And do you have any issues with 3-day sickness, anything like that here, or are you a little drawer for that?
No, we do, some years are worse than others, I guess. We probably haven't had a bad year.
We haven't had a crash with it, touch wood, but, it's just another thing you've got to deal with. But it does, we've never had it wipe heaps, you know, have heaps of steers go down with it or something. And we probably don't run them intensively enough where it does, you know, affect the heat. Some people, if they're rotational or cell grazing or something, if they get an outbreak, it can put a lot of cattle on the ground. Whereas, we definitely get it from time to time, but no, it's not a major issue for us.
Okay. Do you grow any winter feed for your cattle, or you just rely on native or your established perennials?
Yeah, that's that protein drought, I guess, over winter is something that, it'd be something we'd like to find a solution to. Whether that's, there's a lot of people around that grow an oats crop or something, or Jeremy's idea probably to be have country down south that you could have just breeders here and send young cattle down there to grow out. But, in the current, how we're operating at the minute. It's just, I guess we'd like to, if we can improve our pastures here, not across the board, but in certain paddocks through like legumes or things like that. But it's not, it's not an easy fix. There's not really a legume that's really suited to our area.
There's a few that people use, but we haven't heard anyone have roaring success.
No, it's not. Mm. They're not easy.
Okay.
So, that's probably one of the downsides of it's where we are here. It's like a pretty reliable rainfall. We do have things that like the fly and there's dingoes and things like that. But overall, it's pretty reliable area that grows, a bulk of fairly high quality feed, and it does get hot and it does get cold, but the cattle do well here generally.
Okay. Now it is known to be a bit hot here in the summertime. What sort of runner temperatures would you get here normally? And I guess I ask that from an Angus perspective, just to give people a bit of context.
It'll get into the 40s, no worries, but that's probably at the extremes, Jules, isn't it? We'll be mid to high 30s for an extended period of time. And that just comes down to management of with our yards. We don't have big walks for our cattle. We've got a fair few sets of yards about the place, and you just start early. And yeah, the Angus handle in this country, no worries at all, I would say.
And when did you get into Angus cattle in your career? You might have always been in them. When did you start?
And I've been trying to think exactly. It would be at least 30 years ago. It could be 35 years ago. We were all Herefords. It was a Hereford area. They had two Hereford sales a year, special sales in Roma. And you'd be flat out finding a straight Hereford herd, I reckon, around the district now. But, yeah, it was a big Hereford herd. And we had a feedlot. Well, Dad fed cattle through the 90s. And early 2000s, and buying in cattle, yeah, the black cattle fed well and didn't get sick and stuff like that. And we Dad was a big trader of cattle, and at one stage he near went out of breeders and just full trading, but then changed mid stride. And yeah, once he made the decision to go black, well, we bought a couple of lots of cows and sort of, yeah, bred our way black, basically. It takes a long time to do that, but that was how we started. We seen that they foraged good and in the feedlot they fed well and didn't get sick, and and they were acceptable in the market, I guess. They were, even back then, you know, that was sort of at the start of things, and we were one of the early adopters of the Angus in this area. I'm not saying we're the earliest or anything, but we were one of the early ones to go a straight black herd, yeah.
Okay. And can you tell us a bit about your operation? How many breeders do you have, and when do you calve here, and what's your program, I guess? What's a good overview?
Yeah, we're running probably about 1,100 breeders at the minute, joined, and then, Jeremy's parents have got about 200 breeders that we sort of run. We're separate, but sort of like we buy their weaners and take through. We've sort of changed things around a few times in the last probably 5 years. We used to sell probably 80% of our progeny off as a weaner, all at one sale in Roma, like steers and heifers. And then that sort of, we did feed our own cattle for maybe three. Coles, yeah. We were feeding for Coles, just our own. We've got a small feedlot that until recently was NFAS accredited. So we were doing that. And then, probably 18 months we've been, selling as feeders instead of that, which is... that's working well at the minute. So we do a feature sale, I guess you'd say, of anywhere from sort of 100 to 200 heifers, depending on how many we're keeping and things. But we sort of target them at the replacement female market. They're treated fairly well, the same as our keep heifers. The remainder of the heifers and the steers are all trying to grow out to a sort of a heavy feeder. So that's the program.
We calve in from end of July to the start of October, basically, August. Yeah, we're August, September calving, really. Wean in early May. And that's about it as a snapshot of what we do. It's a self-replacing herd, I guess. We keep our own heifers, and that's a big, the females are what we stand on, if that makes sense. We're all about the females. So.
And with your feeder steers, they go direct to feedlots, I guess, in closer towards Dalby. Is that where they head?
Yeah, we've sold sort of pretty well exclusively to Stockyard Beef at Kiwi, I think.
Yep.
And yeah, heifers are a bit more sort of flexible.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Whoever's got the money, I guess.
Yeah.
With the heifer, with that feeder heifer job. But yeah, Kiwi's been great to deal with, and yeah, well, that's where we've sold since we went that way, and it was just a phone call, and yeah, we've got a good relationship with them. So yeah,
now you've done very well establishing this sale for replacement heifers, I guess, or breeders in the area. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how did you come to do that, and how's that working for you?
I guess it sort of it just evolved fairly organically. We were selling the all of the weaners, and then when we started to feed our own, it was just the steer portion. So I guess we'd seen while we were selling the steers and heifers at the start, in the early days, the steers would get a massive, you know, premium over the heifers. Yep. And then, yeah, when you sort of sat back and looked at the trend over the years, the heifers started to gain on the steers, and then eventually went round them, sort of dollars per kilo. So I guess it's not something that we probably set out to do. It just came about because we could see that there was really strong interest in our females, and then that sort of coincided, I guess, with us feeding the steer portion. So, the branding side of things, again, that was... it just evolved. Like it started off, you know, it was just really me. I'd always had a bit of an interest in photography, and I had little kids and like young kids. It was my way of sort of contributing. Yeah. I used to just take photos and put stuff on Facebook, really like social media, and sort of evolved from that, putting things together. And then I, just tried to sort of polish it. A little bit. It's something that I enjoy doing, telling story, I suppose.
Julie's probably understated that a little bit for the listeners is that Jeremy and Julie have got a real following. And often marketing gets associated in Angus cattle with seed stock or stud sales, and there's certainly great marketers there, but you've really gone for... There's not that many commercial operators around Australia that have carved out a real presence and a brand and a following. You've now got a website, don't you? Has it been good for your business?
I'll cut you off there. But no, Julie's done an amazing job getting them out there, and yeah, the following blows me away, and people know JS Grazing from Victoria to the top, the top of the country, you know, and I think a lot of that's from social media, really. And just to go back on those females hitting their straps, like I think it was, we it's where we wanted to go, you know, like you can be middle of the road by any sort of bull and just have a black beast or whatever, but yeah, we wanted to get as good a quality herd as we could, and invested a lot in genetics and stuff, and I think that started coming through in our females, didn't it? Our cattle, basically, and yeah, it's our and I keep coming back to it. The cows are our engine room, sort of like they're our what we hang our hat on, I guess, and yeah, it's I think that when we started seeing that those heifers out doing the steers, well, yeah, we it's sort of a bit of vindication on what you're doing is you're on the right track, basically.
I think it's extraordinary. You've taken, if you look at it from a business point of view, you've taken the second tier of your business and you've turned it into your top shelf, haven't you, really, is what you've done there. Was it hard to get that reputation established, or how did you... You said it's organic and easy, but what you've done is quite unique. What were some of those steps?
I think it's just, Jeremy and I are not ones to, we are quite different in that, yeah, I do like to plan and know what's coming, and Jeremy is quite flexible. But in saying that, it's not like we sort of sat down and had like this business plan. It's all come from
wanting to breed good cattle,
yeah,
I think.
And so we often disagree on a lot of things, but we'll never, if we sit down to have a planning meeting, like, yeah, it'll be an argument every 5 minutes. But if we're in the paddock or working with, you know, yeah, in the yards or whatever, we have more arguments over who's got to unpack the dishwasher or how you pack it correctly than we'd ever have in the paddock. So I think we've always been on the same page and clear in, like, what it is that we're wanting, you know, that this time when you've weaned everything off and you're going through and picking your key peppers, we've always been really clear on where we're headed in that aspect, and the other stuff has just come from there. And we both are always in agreement that consistency, like, you want to produce, you know, say you've got, you know, 500 heifers in the yard or whatever, or you're mustering, you know, a mob or whatever, and you don't just want to see, like, pick out, oh, that's a nice heifer, or it's having, trying to get it where they're like peas in a pod, and and it's lifting that bar so where your average is at high level, I guess. I'm not sure if that's so clear on that. But,
and you have an annual sale, Julie, don't you?
Yes, we do, but it's not, like, we've been probably a little bit flexible the last couple of years in terms of, you know, at one point it was always, you know, on a certain
date. First in July.
Yes. But we aim to put up sort of at least, you know, 100 to 200 heifers that are, you know, whoever buys them, they're ready to join. They're vaccinated through the same program that we basically treat them like an extension of our key peppers, and they really are aimed at that.
The top-end replacement females, I'd say, yeah.
And is that through one of the Roma sales?
Yep.
Yeah,
yeah, we have been. Every year we just sell through just a normal store sale in Roma, and, this year we're going to dip our toe in, we're going to put them on Auctions Plus this year. Just, I was always of the opinion that because people have got to pay a fair bit for our heifers, that if I was going to be paying money, I'd want to be looking at them, you know, I'd want to go and see them, whereas the world's changed a lot in the last even 5 to 10 years. And, yeah, that's, people are, you know, there's so much footage and everything of them now, and word of mouth and stuff, that, yeah, you get a lot more coverage, I'm thinking. Like, we've always done for the last 5 to 10 years, we've done an online element to our sale. They can bid online, and that goes with the live auction. But, yeah, this year we're going to try and see how we go now with Auctions Plus. Yeah, we think they're doing a great job, and, yeah, it's... We'll see.
Anyway, that's excellent. You get the same people competing for those heifers each year. You got to created a bit of a.
We have a good following, but not in saying that, we probably don't get the same people. Definitely don't get the same people buying them year in, year out. They'll be competing on them, but there's always, someone new with them who wants to try what we're doing, or got a bit more money or whatever, you know. Those people bought them for 2 and 3 years, but there's no one buys them 10 years in a row or anything like that. They just, I guess they, you can't just keep buying heifers. I suppose you can, but we've definitely had them buy them 2 and 3 years in a row and stuff. But yeah, it's always good to see new people and see the people who bought your cattle before come back and be walking the lanes and inquiring about them. So, yeah, we get it's a mix, I guess.
Did you start out to try to establish a brand? Did you have a vision at the start and think, we could create this commercial brand that's quite different from, I think, quite unique. It's very different than the stud industry. So did you have that vision or did it sort of come to you along on the way?
I'd like to say that we did, but I don't.
Guess we were.
We started with the logo. That's probably the first that I can remember. We were down, we were still at Ben Lomond at the time. So, Henry, that'd be like maybe 18 years ago, something like that. Yep. I can remember we had a very distinct idea of what we wanted the logo to look like, and we didn't have a website or anything at that stage, and we weren't sort of pushing anything. I can't remember what the instigator was to.
It was when we went to Wieners when we come back from down south, because we used to send Wieners from here down to our Ben Lomond country and grow them out down there. And we did sums on the Wiener job because everyone around us down there was selling Wieners. And you can make figures do what you want, but we thought we could run a few more cows and do just as well out of the Wiener job up here. And people were going down the south to buy a black calf, so we thought we could, we thought they'd buy them on their doorstep. And probably in the early years, especially when the heifers were taken off, like they were going south. Like it was funny. Instead of the steers would definitely stay anyway from here to northern New South Wales, but the heifers, I know we sold heifers into South Australia and everywhere out of that sale. And that was interesting or strange or whatever. But I think it was just something a bit novel to line up that many black calves this far north. You know, that's what set us apart in the start, I think. Yeah.
Okay. It's quite interesting. We talk about the Angus premium, then you've taken a step further and now you've got a J.S. Grazing premium in the Angus world, which is, you know, quite good. And I think it's a bit of a, it's really something special for our Angus commercial people to be thinking about. How do you add value to your operation? And you've done it well. What do you think has been over the last few years, what sort of premium have you managed to get in the marketplace, do you think?
It varies year on year, but for a Wiener heifer, I think we could be getting $300 to $500 above the normal, and some years it was a lot more in the silly times. I think it'd be $300 to $500 on top of the market rate, you know.
That's excellent. That's a real achievement, isn't it? That's all and essentially all profit, really, which is a credit to you.
A lot of that we spend it to get it. It all makes the world go round. We do spend a fair bit of money on bulls and genetics, and it takes a. It's not just easy, like it doesn't. I don't know how to say it, but you know, you've got to continually keep aiming for something, I guess, and you can't sit back and rest on your laurels, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It does. There's some good lessons. What would you say to commercial producers then in a similar position yourself across Australia, New Zealand that listen to this podcast? What would be some advice you'd say if you're trying to get a better outcome for your commercial operation? What would you say some of the keys?
Julie's probably a better one to answer it, but I'd just say back yourself. That's my biggest motto, is if you don't be afraid to have a go. Mm.
And that probably I can remember, like the AIing has really, I think that's been a massive tool for us that's had, a big impact on our herd, like the quality of our herd. Like we started, have a crack. So I went and did just freshly married. I went and did a preg testing course down at near Tamworth somewhere. Come back and I taught Jeremy how to preg test, and we both went to an AI course. we bought 60 commercial heifers
from Fred Bell, Glen Avon sales back then, and yeah, bought a bull, a top price yearling bull, I think he was at the time, a T-Mania Infinity bull out of Millamurra. That was the first year we went down there, and we just did a course and had a crack, and I think we didn't do too bad that year either. You get the highs and lows in the AI, but yeah, we just had a go, I guess, and we do all our AI. We only AI our heifers, but we do it ourselves. I just like that, being able to do it ourselves, and it's a rewarding when the calves are hitting the ground now. Yeah, it's good.
Now, you just to dig into your program a bit, you use natural bulls, so you're buying registering bulls, natural bulls for your cow herd, and is it your heifers that you're primarily doing an AI program to lift the quality? Is that what you?
Yeah, that's we did try 1 year. We'd love to do cows. It's just here it's a bit tricky. It's just like the paddock sizes and things. It's, you know, to have cows in the yards and handling them with calves on them for sort of that few weeks is a bit difficult. So the heifers are easy, and we've just, I think probably the last 2 or 3 years, you can really see a lift in our cattle. And I think that's like when you go back and keep, you wean the heifers calf, they don't always, at the point of weaning, they don't always look the best, but it's trusting in that genetic potential. And I think since we have maybe been a bit forgiving on them when we're selecting our keep heifers, it's amazing. Like we've noticed between having the feedlot, selling the, you know, that female sale, and then our keepers, when you really start looking at where they're coming from, the first steers into the feedlot or hitting, you know, those entry weights, it's amazing how many of them are coming from our maiden heifers, and it's just they catch up and overtake quite quickly.
I think that's the genetic potential of the Louis and some, industry-leading size, I guess, in a commercial operation. So, yeah, I think you get what you pay for, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And there's been a lot of years we'll buy as good a heifer bull as we can and use him for 2 years in the AI. Yeah, we'll AI with him and then back up with him just to get a bang for your buck, I guess. Make the most of that purchase. And, yeah, we can't buy all the bulls we want, but yeah, if we can buy that really as good a bull as we can and a heifer bull as we can and use him for a couple of years, but we have been using just stud AI sires for the last few years, haven't we? I think that all that sort of keeping those heifers, and yeah, you can really see our herd lifting. I'm sure you can. Yeah.
And what are you looking for in as a cattleman? What are you looking for in those bulls that you're buying or the semen? So what are the traits you're looking to improve your female herd?
Phenotypes probably always, like there's certain things that Jeremy and I talk about it a fair bit. Like I think nature, my belief is if you push really hard in one area, nature always has a give and take. So I think that'll come at a cost somewhere else. So unless there's something that you're really, really looking to in your herd, which is a very personal thing. But generally we're, you know, in terms of figures, we're probably not pushing hard in anything, but something that's just fairly even across the board. But the phenotypes, trying to breed an animal that we like the you know, like the look of.
Yeah, they've got to be soft. They've got to be long and deep, you know.
Good head. That's probably my the first thing I notice, like when you look at, go and look at bulls in a pen and when we're selecting heifers, that probably comes from my dad a bit.
So it's a real balanced approach.
Yeah. I'd say so. Yeah. But that definite phenotype, well, we've got a powerful, I'd say we select a bulls with plenty of power, but they're going to be soft and deep and long. Yeah, I know that probably sounds pretty simple, but yeah, that's with a good head and structurally, they got to tick a fair few boxes, and then we look at the EBVs, if that makes sense. Yeah, the EBVs are a tool, but they're just that to us anyway. We've got a type of beast, and
you don't have a tough. Wouldn't call it a tough environment. In fact, it's probably a pretty special part of country in terms of it can be really good here, can't it, at Injun, but you've got some challenges.
Yeah.
How are you, the bulls you're buying and how are your cows you're keeping yourself? What sort of longevity are you getting in those animals?
Well, from the cow side of things, like we cull it 10 years of age, but we...
Then we get another calf.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do. Like we go through, cull it at 10, but anything that's pregnant and which is, most of them all, they, if we think they're going to hold up, we carve them out, just don't rejoin and carve them out. So, you know, some cows here would probably go on to 12 or 13.
Yeah.
That's sort of the safe approach, I guess, because it can get, you know, there's a bit, particularly the last few years here, like we're not guaranteed of getting that break in October. Like it...
You could wait till February some years and, that puts a bit of strain on those older cows. But, and the bulls are pretty much the same. I think we'd be above, we'd get longer out of our bulls than what the industry standard is, and I don't think that's anything special, but I think our bulls will last till anywhere from 8 to 10 year old, depending on injuries, like, you always get your losses through, whether it be a broken pistol or getting hurt somehow, and like foot abscess or something, you know, on rocky country, we put a fair bit of time into them bulls, those young bulls, so we, you know, we'll look after them if they are starting to look a bit rough or something during that first joining, and we'll get them out and look after them a bit, you know, just to set them up, I guess. You know, you could put them out and leave them out and they'd be skin and bones and they're never going to look any good, I guess. But if you put a bit of time into them, and if you get a bull that's lame, you spend the time and ride out and get him and look after him, you know, and they pay you back, I think.
Okay. All right. No, that's an excellent answer. Sometimes we can get criticism in the breed, but that's certainly not your experience, is it? You've got fantastic longevity in both your cow and your bullhood.
I think, and don't get me wrong, you'll have bad years with bulls, just injuries, you know, but you'll have good years when we don't get any injuries too.
Yeah, we probably have, or Jeremy's, maybe the last 2 years, we haven't put the joining ratio, we've pushed it a bit. So I think we want to...
Under 40. We were always 1 to 30 cows, and I think we'll get a few more injuries just with more bulls and fighting, and I think we've had less injuries and lost less bulls in the last few years by going to that extended ratio, and we're improving our
pregnancy rates
to 97%. We got this year, and that's over three, that is over a 3 month, like where we'd love to shorten it. I would anyway, love to shorten it to sort of, well, 9 weeks, but yeah, we're in this, it's not, biggest mob would be 200 odd cows and they're over a few thousand acres. Yeah, it's not intensive by any means. So we do well over that 3 month period. So I think we'll stick to that.
Okay. Okay. Oh, that's great. From a business point of view, what do you hold as some pretty close family values that you apply to your business? Is there anything that stands out?
Probably hard to verbalise, but we do everything. Like we've got a 13 and a 15-year-old, two boys, and Jeremy and I both only children, so it's a fairly tight set inner circle, yeah. Really. But
family's a big thing to us, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, we do it, and I know. Yeah, probably moving forward, like I probably do have a belief that. It's a family operation, but you can be smart about that as well. So trying to, take more of a structured sort of approach, I think, particularly moving forward when the boys will come home and be involved in some way, shape or form. So having a few more structures around things, I think, is necessary.
Integrity, I think, standing behind your brand or your cattle. Don't lie, I guess. The cattle are going to talk for himself. Like, you can pump them up all you want, but these days with everything's measured and they know exactly how your cattle do and stuff, I think, just be as honest as you can and let the cattle do the talking, I think.
Okay.
I don't know if that's...
Seems to be working for you so far, yeah. Have you got plans to expand or change the operation going forward?
On a daily basis from Jeremy's point of view. Yeah. Here we have very different appetites for risk. Also, we'd love to scale what we do, That's the challenge with family, farming and operations is, it's a tricky space, How do you... I know I don't like risk, but I also recognise that there's a risk in standing still. So, and for both boys to come home, like, you've got to sort of keep pushing and growing and... it's getting harder and harder to do. Yeah. We are not the only ones facing those challenges. Yeah. So I think...
Country here has obviously got very expensive in this part of the world. It's pretty safe grazing, isn't it? Like, it's a well-recognised grazing area. How do you combat that, or how do you work with that to try and expand in what I guess is... dollars per cow area keeps getting more expensive.
That's a million-dollar question, I reckon.
Well, several million dollars. Yeah. We've got to go somewhere else, basically. We'd love to buy in the area, but it's that hard to scale, to get to a scale where we want to be. So whether we go west, wouldn't really like to take our cows north too far, if that makes sense. I think we can go west into a breeder operation or run more cows here, like turn this and bring them back to here and grow them out here, or breed here and go take them south to grow them out on some high rainfall country.
What took you to Ben Lomond originally? I lived near Ben Lomond. It's the extreme opposite end of the spectrum to Injun, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I always gone to school and that everyone wanted to go north, and I always wanted to go south. I guess I've always been probably when I think back now, I've always liked the quality over quantity, if that makes sense.
And for those that don't know Ben Lomondera, it's about 1,400 metres above sea level at times, and it's quite cold in the winter, only grows grass for probably 7 months of the year, and it's basalt country, very productive, high rainfall, very intensive stocking. So quite different production system, isn't it?
It was. We had a place at between Roma and Condamine, and we sold that probably sooner than we thought we were going to. It was always a block with turnover, and anyway, I think Mum was out of debt for 13 days. We worked out. We found a block Bueller at Ben Lomond, and went and Dad. I guess that's Dad. He's very responsible for thinking he wanted to give me a crack and do that, and it was great. We liked it. It was a great area. We had great neighbours, and we had a great part of the. It was a great place to come home to. It was green grass and running water, and we probably didn't see it as at that time the feet over the fence, and that we probably didn't see one of those real extreme years, and it got dry there one time, didn't it? But we got through it good, and the cattle did well. Everyone said we wouldn't be able to take wieners from here and land them down there in the middle of winter, but they grew a bit more hair, and they did good.
It probably just like at the time it was just Jeremy's parents up here, and we were doing like nearly passing ourselves. It got dry up here, and there was a lot more work up here than where we were. So from an operational perspective at the time, it sort of didn't.
It's probably a 7-hour run between places.
Yeah.
It would have been
something. It could be more, you could load up a truck full of horses and dogs and come up here, and everything was going to be fine down there. We'd come up here for a fortnight and a month or whatever we used to have to come up here for. But, just the operational and logistical side of things, it made sense to centre ourselves back up here, really.
And I think moving, we're sort of at that stage now, Jeremy's always looking, but sort of our short term or the next one to 2 years is try and get everything really humming here, at the, what in the country we have here at the minute. There's still quite a bit that we can do to just get it running at absolute capacity, and then knowing that within sort of maybe 5 or so years you've got 5-8 years, you've possibly got two boys coming home. That I think it'd be a good time to sort of step into something then. But in saying that, country's only getting dearer.
Mm.
So we've always got our...
You always got to look and have a look about. I drive Julie a bit mad at times looking at places. But, you've always got to take the opportunity when it turns up, I guess.
Now, to change tax law, Angus in Queensland, outside the tick areas, what do you think's the future? There's still a lot of mixed herds up here. I think we do a survey in Queensland. It's about 17% of the cattle in Queensland have got an Angus component, which is much lower than the other states. What do you see as the future for Angus, especially in these western Queensland districts? Do you see a lot of growth potential? While driving out here this morning, you've got a lot of red cattle, a lot of standard herds, different herds there. Do you think the breed will continue to grow in this part of the world?
Yeah, I think here, definitely what we've seen just in our local area is there's been a real sort of push towards Angus.
Yeah, definitely in around here. I've seen it in the last probably 10 years that, it's amazing the amount of black bulls come into this area now, whereas there wasn't too many at all a while ago. And whether it's definitely because of the great job that Angus and Angus Australia have done with promoting the breed and their market acceptability and all that. I'm not sure how, if a lot of people go to a straight Angus herd, or they're definitely using them to cross over, crossbred cows or any of that more Vicinagus type cow to get a bit more market acceptance. And I think that's where I see that lighting get bigger and better. I'm not sure how many will go straight. I'm not sure. There's when you go further north, you get into the wag. Like, there's a lot of big herds of wags getting built in the north. I'm not sure if that's going to continue or what'll happen in that space. But definitely from here into Western Queensland, it'll only continue to get bigger and better for the Angus, I think.
Hmm. And if you're a crossbred or a different breed producer and you haven't tried an Angus bull before, what would be some of your advice you'd give to someone if they're tipping their toe into an Angus cross into their system? What would be some advice from your learnings, I guess?
You buy a bull that'll suit your herd or where you want to go. If you're wanting to go over, you're looking for a different sort of bull than maybe I am, you know, like you want a softer, earlier maturing bull, whatever. Like, they talk about the slick Queensland coat. I'm not sure if that's a marketing thing or what, the Queensland coat. But, yeah, the shorter haired cattle seem to be more favourable, from a marketing perspective into Queensland. I don't mind a bit of hair, but that's definitely been a push in this area. I'd say find someone's cattle you like and talk to the breeder. Like, get a good relationship with a stud stock person that you like their cattle.
And see,
drive about, get in the car and go and look. Don't just buy it a sale because it's close to you. Yeah, get out and have a look about, and really, because a good relationship with a seed stock producer is money in the bank. I think they can, they'll help you as much as you'll help them, that's for sure.
It's an interesting point you raise, and you don't have to mention the person you work with, but I find a lot of people jump about, whether it's in the breed or business. That's not your experience at all. You've got a long, deep relationship with your supplier. Just tell us a little bit about how that's added value to your business.
We bought it a lot of sales, didn't we, Jules? And
that was in the
New England?
In the earlier days?
In the early days, we had a type and we did well out of that, I guess, by shopping around. But we found a stud operation that we liked the way, we had the same beliefs in cattle, I guess, and liked the same type of cattle. And so we've been using Millamara for,
nearly probably
17 or 18 years. We've been
exclusive for probably, it'd be 12, be more than 10 years anyway, but the consistency of the first time that we went there and walked into the pen, what struck the both of us about the Millamara cattle were just the consistency. Yeah, and that sort of hones in with what we're trying to achieve, in that the ideal for us is you look over a mob of cows or a mob of weaners or whatever of ours and they all look the same. And you're trying to lift that bottom end, I guess, and that's what...
That's what took us about the cattle, and they're long, deep cattle, and we've travelled a bit with the Thompsons to New Zealand and seen the cattle over there. Julie and I just had a family holiday in New Zealand, and we went and we've had a fairly long association with Stern Angus as well, which is... The cattle have been heavily used in Australia, and we've become friends with the Fraser family over there, and love their cattle and the type of cattle that they're breeding. And
has there been some advantage to? So you've been growing your brand separately. So you bought your genetics, but you've been developing this commercial brand, which is really strong. Has it been helpful having that long relationship? And it wouldn't matter who you have that with, but is it a two-way street, I guess?
Absolutely, yeah. On a number of levels, like I know there's, you'd know more about it than me probably with the Auctions Plus and the Ross talks about like the premium that the Miller Murrah cattle have achieved on that. So there's, yeah, when, you know, people know that that's where we're sourcing our bulls from and how well, you know, they're performing at, on a whole, you know, there's that link. But also that just the conversations that you can have. Mm. And
that's with any, like any, it could be with any stud breeder, couldn't it? But, yeah, the conversations you can have about cattle and the way things are going and sire lines and cow lines and Julie loves to dig into the pedigrees of cattle and stuff like that. So, yeah, just having those conversations with your seed stock producer.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of an art, that matching. Mm. It intrigues me and I don't know as, you know, much about it as I'd like to, but, you know, the matching of, you know, how Ross puts what bulls he's putting over certain cows, and I think that, yeah, that's a real art form. And so, yeah, having that, I think, yeah, we hosted a young beef producers a few years ago at a farm tour, and that was one thing, like, we got asked about similar sort of questions, like how you go about choosing bulls or studs or whatever. And that was, it's just having that relationship because it, you know, what we're looking for mightn't be what the next person's looking for, but A is knowing what that is, knowing where you're headed and having a bit of clarity about how you think you can get there. But then, yeah, just having that relationship so that you also know that the cattle you're trying to breed is what they're trying to breed.
So, produce, yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's what I struck when I first listened to your talk in Emerald, there's a simplicity to your business model. And I know when I came into this role as CEO, often people are a bit reticent to follow simple formulas. And as I've gone on and I've had the fortune to look at a lot of operations around Australia and New Zealand, more than anyone, I guess. And what strikes me is that successful people have a really simple formula that they stick to and they just hone it and they work away at it. They're very sure about what they want to do. And that talking to you, that seems to... Yeah. Come out and then that compounds over time. It's a bit like compound interest in the bank, isn't it? That it you don't have to jump all around and get the latest fads and latest ideas to be ultra successful. And I think you're probably a testament to that.
No, just try and, yeah, breed as good to breed as good a cow as we can. I guess that is what it all comes down to. Breed the cow and the progeny will follow the steers and that'll flow on from there. And yeah, I think that it's definitely simple. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel or anything. We're just trying to produce a good animal, I guess.
You don't often have the opportunity to speak to the whole Angus community in Australia and New Zealand. What would you, if you had a message to the Angus breeding community, commercial seed stock, what would be something you'd say to the Angus community?
I'd say remember where Angus, what made Angus great. We're not a Wagyu, we're an Angus that has been created for hundreds of years, and what made us great wasn't chasing a fad, I guess. And so I'd say stay true to type. And yeah, I think Angus has done a great job, but I'd like him to stay true.
Yeah, I guess that it's always been, you know, our breed, like a beautiful Angus cow has always been, you know, really appealing to me. And I guess that's very similar to Jeremy in that I think that phenotype of, and, you know, the fertility and the things that make Angus stand out as a breed, don't lose sight of that, I guess, and that it sort of ties in with what you were saying before about, you know, doing the simple things really well, like, a feminine cow that's fertile and let the phenotype lead the way, I suppose.
Mm. Good advice. Good advice. I didn't give you a heads up on this question, but it's a pretty easy one. Hopefully you'll know the answer to it. Is I always ask people, look, we're in the beef industry, you enjoy beef. What's the best beef eating experience you've ever had?
Jules, but just some of the steak we've produced here, I think is, we've had a lot of lovely dinners at places, lovely steak and whatever, but some of my most memorable meals have been around the table here, I guess, and what we've produced, and you know, you've seen him as a calf and fed him right through. Yeah, that's mine.
Yeah, that's probably a pretty good answer.
That's great. That's wonderful. Yeah. Actually, I've asked this question. We've done about 35 of these interviews, and it used to get really interesting answers from people, and they'd mention some restaurants and things which were great experiences. But then in recent times, nearly that answer is this consistent thread, and I love it. I think it's great. I travel a lot, and I'll often say to we kill our own, and I'll often say to my wife, can you just get some meat out of the freezer? Can you get a steak out if I've been away for a week and I come home? And it's amazing to me how resonating that is across the Angus family, whether it's here in June or whether it's in another part of Australia. It's a wonderful blessing that we have, and people often say just having that meat they've raised themselves on pasture that tastes great and with family is that's the most common answer we get. So it's a pretty good reflection of the breed when people are enjoying that.
Yeah, that's interesting. You probably get a bit numb to it. Like we probably are fairly spoiled, and it's like you say, if you travel, you've been away from home, that it is that little bit of a reminder of sort of how lucky you are. But we do kill our own. We have a local guy that comes in and cuts them up. But it's interesting from if I look at like how we used to package stuff up like 10, 15 years ago to how we do it now. Yeah. Like it takes a bit of time, but we cry back everything, and probably have realised like the value of the meat that you have. But yeah, no, that's interesting that you say that's coming through as a thread.
Very common, and I think what's great when you've got a beast that you've killed is you have to use all the cuts.
Yes.
And sometimes people only use what's called the sweet cuts or the better steaks, and I think that's just a crying shame that people don't use every part of the beast, because often the best flavour comes from the cuts that are certainly not the most tender, are they?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I just said the last, I can't think of the word, but sort of started this time, hadn't planned for it exactly, but I said to Jeremy, next time we do a killer, I'm going to have the next day, when we package it up, I'll have the next day as well sort of put aside to do I made the rissoles and made sausage rolls and did all that sort of stuff and packaged that as well. And I think, like, if you book out a day to do that, you're just making, like what you're saying, you're making the most of the entire animal and, like, value adding on just a very local or in-house scale.
Yeah.
Which is some of the healthiest food on the planet.
Exactly.
Yep. Well, look, thank you for your time today. It's been a privilege to have such a great family story, very heartfelt, and it's been a great business success for you both. And from the Angus Society point of view, thank you for your long-standing support for the breed. And it's been wonderful to come here and sit around the table this morning and have a chat. And I'm sure the listeners will be really appreciative of your story. So. Thank you both for coming on the Angus Table, and thank you for sharing a bit of your life.
Thank you very much, Pam.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasbourg. Until next time, all the best.